Today is January the 21st, and we are continuing in Sanhedrin. And I told you that today we would speak about Daftari Aleph Amud Aleph, the story of Gvir ben Pesisa and the three different Umayyads that come to bring Klal Yisrael to Din in front of, as the Gemara says, Alexandros Mukdon, which is Alexander the Great, and known as Macedonia, right? Macedon. Now, there's three stories here. The first one involving the Canaanim, the second one involving the Mitzrim, and the third one involving the Bnei Yishmael and the Bnei Keturah. The Canaanim come before Alexander, and they want to have a din with him about how Klal Yisrael took away their land. So, in all three cases, Gvir ben Pesisa follows the same pattern. He says to the Chachamim, let me go and represent Klal Yisrael in the court case. If they win, then you could say you defeated a Hedyot, you defeated a simpleton. He was not one of the Talmidei Chachamim. And if I win, you can say the Torah beat them. And he goes, and each time he says to them, where do you want to bring a raya from? And they say, from the Torah. So he said, okay, I'll also bring a raya from the Torah. And then he defeats their position based on a counter raya from the Torah. That's all three cases. What I want to do is go through each case, but then we also have to get a better sense for the historical place of Alexander the Great within the Talmidei Chachamim, within the hierarchy of what's going on in Klal Yisrael, so we understand what's happening here with these Dinei Torah that they're bringing. So the first one is that Canaan comes and they say that Klal Yisrael took away our land, because the Torah says Eretz Canaan Likvulay Seha, that Klal Yisrael gets Eretz Canaan. Well, Eretz Canaan means the land of Canaan. That means it belongs to Canaan. So Gvir ben Pesisa says, if you're bringing right from the Torah, then I'll bring right from the Torah. Because even though it says that it's Eretz Canaan, but it also says, the pasuk says, Vayomer Arur Canaan. Canaan is cursed. Eved Avadim Yelechav. A slave to his slaves will be to his brothers. So Eved Shekhan Nechasim, Eved Lamim Nechasim Lamim. An Eved that acquires Nechasim, property. So who owns the Eved and who owns the property? So Alexander turned to the Canaanim and said, well, your turn. Answer him. So they said, give us 3 days. He did. And they couldn't find any way of responding. And so they ran away, because they were afraid that now they're going to be taken as slaves. So they ran away. And then Klal Yisrael was able to take their fields and their vineyards fully grown. And Klal Yisrael was able to get those fields and vineyards that were fully grown. And the Gemara says that year was a Shemitah year. And that was from where, the Gemara doesn't say it explicitly, but that's where they were able to get Parnassa from. They were able to get food from those fields.
Could you tell me the beginning of the Gemara that says Ba'arba, the Esrim Ba'arba, then you said it's not Tilu, it's the Mosnaim, Yehuda, Mishalim, Ukshabab in Africa? We didn't get the connection between those two.
Okay, that's a good point. Let's go back then. The Gemara says, turn around, Bonan. On the 24th of Nisan, those who were tining against Yehuda and Yerushalayim were taken away. Rashi says, what? How does he translate that? Right, those who are coming to steal from Klal Yisrael. So that's a quote from Megillas Tainis. So Megillas Tainis, which sounds like from its name, it's going to tell you the Megillah just means a scroll. It's going to tell you when Tanesim are, when you're supposed to fast, but Megillas Tainis is the exact opposite of that. Megillas Tainis are the dates you're not allowed to fast. That's the idea of Megillas Tainis. These are the dates when big things happened in Klal Yisrael, and those are the dates when you're not allowed to fast. And most of Megillas Tainis is Batel. We say Batel Megillas Tainis, that after the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, after the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, so then there was so much sorrow in Klal Yisrael that Megillas Tainis became Batel. Many dates that are there, but wonderful things that happened to Klal Yisrael, dates that became basically holidays, they were then treated as regular days because of the Chorban HaBayis. The exception being... which one?
Purim?
Not Purim. Purim's not in there. Chanukah. Purim is in Tanakh. You don't need Megillah's Tainus for that. Chanukah is not in Tainus. The dates that are post Tanakh. Chanukah is in Megillah's Tainus, and that still lasts to today. But most of Megillah's Tainus is Batal. So one of the dates that are in Megillah's Tainus that they used to celebrate during the second Beis Hamikdash was Chaf Dalet Nisan. That was a special date on the calendar, Chaf Dalet Nisan, and it was the date when they finally defeated their antagonist before Alexander. Now, I don't know if it means the first, second, or third cases. Maybe it means the third one, so all three were finally beaten in din in front of Alexander. That's the Hemshech.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, and then it tells you the three cases. So, that's the first case with Canaan. Second case, the Mitzrim came before Alexander, to tell you that Klal Yisrael owes them the money that we took from them in this coming week's Parsha. This coming week's Parsha, in just 2 days, we're going to read how Klal Yisrael took the wealth of Mitzrayim when we left. Hashem told us to take the wealth, and we took it. We left. So they said we owe them the money back. So imagine the interest. So Klal Yisrael said back to... So again, Gvir B'Masisa said... I'll go represent Klal Yisrael, and he does, and he says that you bring your right from the Torah, so I'll also bring your right from the Torah, because in the Torah it says that we were slaves to you for 430 years, so you owe us the money, the schar, for 430 years worth of work that we did for you. So pay us. So again, Alexander said to the Mitzrim, "Skutaina." So the Mitzrim, he said, answer them. The Mitzrim didn't know what to answer. He said, give us 3 days. He gave them 3 days. They couldn't think of an answer. So they ran away. And they left their fields, and which were fully grown, and Klal Yisrael got their fields. Again, that was a Shemitah year, and they got the produce in Shemitah. So why'd they run away? What were they afraid of if they would have stayed?
They would have had to pay up.
They would have had to pay up. So they had to run away. Otherwise, they would have had to pay up.
Pay what?
The 430 years worth of...
You already paid if you took their stuff and they left.
That wasn't worth the amount of money that they owed us. They owed us a lot more than that.
Down payment.
Right.
But it wasn't really 430 years.
Okay, the Marashah says it's Lav Dafka. It wasn't really 430 years. It was really only 136 years, approximately, of slavery. And really only 86 years of really, really bad slavery. But it's still, even so, 600,000 people working for you for that many years, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of... You know,
they didn't work a day and night.
What's that?
They made them work a day and night.
Yeah. Overtime.
Okay. Overtime.
Overtime. Right.
Weekend.
Somebody recently claimed.
Yeah, this happened. It happened recently that there was an Egyptian lawsuit against the Jews for this money. Right. Of course, it doesn't help because the Egyptians living in Egypt today are not necessarily Egyptians.
Yeah.
Right. It could. Some of them maybe, but. Then the third Maisa is the B'nai Yishmael B'nai Keturah came to say that we are all equal heirs to Avraham Avinu. So it's true that we have Eretz Yisrael, but they should also get Eretz Yisrael because Yishmael is an equal heir. So again, Gvir B'Masisa says back that that the Pasuk says that Avraham Avinu gave everything to Yitzchak, and then to the B'nai HaPilag Shem HaShel Avraham he gave Matanos. So he sent them off. And that defeated the allegation of the B'nai Yishmael B'nai Keturah. Now there's a striking difference in the third story than in the first two. The first two, the B'nai Kenana, B'nai Mitzrayim, not only lost the court case, but they also ran away. Because if they didn't run away, they would be in serious trouble. Kenana would have been taken as slaves, and the Mitzrayim would have had to pay up a huge sum of money. So they ran away. The B'nai Yishmael B'nai Keturah lost the battle, but they did not have to run away. There was no consequence to them. It was just a lawsuit that they lost. And maybe they had to pay court costs. I don't know. But they didn't have to pay anything to Klal Yisrael. There was no counter-taina. See, in the first two, Gvir B'Masisa comes back with a counter-taina. You want to bring a lawsuit against us? I'll bring a lawsuit against you. And my lawsuit is much better than yours. So they had to run away. Both cases. But the third one, Gvir B'Masisa successfully defends Klal Yisrael, but does not bring a counter lawsuit against the B'nai Yishmael B'nai Keturah. So that's important to note. So we're going to get back to that. the Marsha over here discussing the first lawsuit, the one from Bnei Kanan, that they want Eretz Yisrael. So he asks, it's very interesting, Marsha, he asks, I don't understand, what's their taina? Because the pasuk says Eretz Kanan Ligvuloi Seha. It's Eretz Kanan. But there's many psukim in the Torah that say that Hashem is giving us Eretz Kanan. So what do you want? I mean, the Torah says that He's giving us Eretz Kanan. If they're bringing a raya from the Torah itself says that Hashem's giving us Eretz Kanan. So what's their complaint? So more than that, says the Marsha, he doesn't understand, why would Gvi Ben Sisa bring a raya from the pasuk of Aror Kanan Eved Avadim Yelechav, that Kanan is cursed, he should be a slave to his brothers, and therefore whatever he owns, his brothers own, because he's their slave. But Kanan has two brothers, Shem and Yefes. And which brother does Alexander come from?
From
he comes from Yefes. He's Yavan. He's from the Greeks. He comes from Yefes. So by answering with this pasuk of Eved Avadim Yelechav, it comes out that now both Shem and Yefes have a claim against Kanan, which means he's essentially telling Alexander, Eretz Yisrael is also half yours. So he may be defending Klal Yisrael against the taina of the Kananim, but he's feeding Alexander a taina that he should be able to take half of Eretz Yisrael.
I don't know what the Marsha answers, but Sadeh Ben Ichai says, that's why he said, Nechassim, he said,
Eved Lemi Nechassim Lemi.
Yeah, Eved Lemi Nechassim Lemi, that Yafis already got the all the Nechassim or something.
It's interesting. Okay. The Marsha answers, the Marsha says that he wants to answer both these kashas, this one and the kasha of why doesn't he just say that the Torah says that Hashem is giving us Eretz Kanan. So he says that the Kananim understood that Hashem gave us Eretz Kanan. After all, we know the first Rashi in Chumash, Amar of Yitzchak, why did the Torah start with Breishis? It should have started with HaChadosh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chadashim, why start with Breishis? So he brings the pasuk of Koyach Ma'asav Higi La'amai, that he told us all that we don't need to know Ma'asav Breishis, all we need to know is that Hashem created the world. Well, it says that in the Aseret HaDibros, that Hashem created the world. We don't need Kisheshes Amim Asa Hashem Asa Shemaim Asa Haaretz. We don't need more than that. Hashem created the world in 6 days. It says it in the Aseret HaDibros. So we don't need the story of Breishis. As the Ramban explains, the story of Breishis is anyway hard to understand. It's not something which we understand anyway. It's something which the Gemara, the Mishnayos and Chagiga caution that you're not supposed to teach Barabbin because it's so difficult to understand.
You're talking Shesha Shema.
Yeah. So why is it there at all? So Rav Yitzchak answers the reason why it's there is to give us a response that if the Umas Taina, you're listim, you're thieves, because you took away the land from the Kananim, we could say Hashem created the world, and therefore He can give it to whoever He wants and take it away from whoever He wants. Yes, He gave it to Kanan initially, took it away and gave it to us. That's why the Torah starts with Breishis, to show that Hashem created the world, we have the right to do whatever Hashem does. So the Ramban explains, that's Rashi brings, the Ramban explains it further, that you see in the whole story of Breishis and Noach that what Hashem does is He gives people things, land, and when they sin, they get kicked off the land. Who's the first one that happened to?
Adam and
Chava. They had Gan Eden, they did have Eretz, they were kicked out. Then when Cain kills Hevel, he goes into Eretz Noit, he has to be go into Golis. And then you have the same thing with the Doha Flaga. They do have Eretz, they get kicked out. He says it's a common, you see that this is the way of the world. That when a people doesn't listen to Chodesh Baruch Hu, they get thrown off their land. So Kanan didn't listen to Chodesh Baruch Hu, got thrown off his land, and it was given to Klal Yisrael. And that's the way of the world. So says the Marsha, the Kananim understood all of that. But they were coming now in the time of Alexander the Great, which is Yavan, which is during the second Beis HaMikdash. Klal Yisrael had been kicked off of our land now for several hundred years. We were off because of the Churban Bayis Rishon. There, we lost the land to the Kastim, to the Babylonians. Then, that land was taken over by Paras Umadai. And then, it was taken over by the Yavanim. And the why is that? Because we did Averis. We follow the same pattern. We were warned in the Torah. We do Averis, we lose the land. That's what it says in the Torah. So the Canaanim were coming to say that, okay, we understand. We had it first. We did Averis. We were thrown off. You were given it. But now you did Averis. So if you did Averis, you were thrown off. And now you don't have it either. So if you don't have it either, you should go back to us. That's the Tana that they have. And that's what they're coming to Alexander for. So Gevi'ah ben Mesuzah couldn't answer that the Torah says that Hashem is going to give us Eretz Canaan, because He did give us Eretz Canaan, then we lost it, because we did Averis. So that's not going to answer why now, during the second Beis HaMikdash, the Canaanim should be removed or shouldn't be able to have Eretz Canaan. So to that, Gevi'ah ben Mesuzah said, no, you're right. That I'm not tining. What I'm tining is that still, you're Avadim. You're an Eved to us. And even though we are currently under the control of Yefes, because Alexander was from Yefes and he was in control of Eretz Yisrael, but so we are under the control of Yefes. We are, so to speak, Avadim to Yefes. But the Pasuk says that Canaan is an Eved Avadim, Yelechav, a slave to slaves. So even though we are Avadim to Yefes, but you are an Eved to an Eved, you're still our Avadim. And therefore you really have no Taina. So he wasn't giving Alexander anything more than Alexander already had. Yes, Alexander had a taina to have Eretz Yisrael, but he had Eretz Yisrael anyway. He had conquered the whole world. It was his. So he was able to keep Eretz Canaan because that he had defeated Klal Yisrael anyway. I mean, it was his. He defeated the Persians and taken over the power in the known world. And so the taina of Aror Canaan Eved Avadim Yelechav doesn't give Alexander any more than he already had, but it denies the Canaanim anything, because whatever they get goes to Shem and Yefes. That was the Taina back. Now, the whole story in front of Alexander is an interesting story, because why Alexander? Meaning, what is this that they're all coming before Alexander to stake their claims? First the Canaanim, then the Mitzrim, then the Ishmaelim. So it's true Alexander was in control of the entire known world, meaning the world that mattered anyway, right? He had the Middle East and he had the whole Mediterranean area and also the Persian area. He had the known world. So good. So if he's in control, he controls Klal Yisrael, he controls all of these nations. He controls the Jews, he controls the Canaanim, he controls the Mitzrim, he controls the Ishmaelim. So you have a forum under which an Ummah can come and take another Ummah to task. Okay, fine, you can't do that, right? You can't... Where were the Egyptians? You know, like we said, recently there was an Egyptian lawsuit against the Jewish people for the money that we took from them. Where are they going to file the lawsuit? In order to file the lawsuit, you have to file it with someone who has control both over the Jews and over Egypt. So if you don't have that, you can't file the lawsuit. So you have to have someone who's in control of everything. So he had control over everything. But he wasn't the first one to have control over everything. Before him, the Persians had control over everything. And before the Persians, the Kastim had control over everything. The Gemara says that Nebuchadnezzar was one of the three people who was Malach B'Kippa. He ruled over the entire known world. Everything. So, and so was Achashverosh. So, why now, in front of Alexander, do they come with these tainas for that they want Eretz Canaan, that they want the money, that they want, you know, why all of a sudden now?
The Malachim clearly had rulership, but they weren't willing to give anyone else dominion over it.
Okay, that's possible. They mean Alexander was the first one who was willing to give some sort of thing. Okay, that's possible. Yeah. That's possible. So the thing is that this is not the only story we have with Alexander the Great in Gemara. The second Beis HaMikdash was built under the leadership of Ezra HaSeifer, who was a Kohen, it was a Kohen Gadol, and Nehemiah, who was also Zerubbabel. The Sefer Ezra Nehemiah. That's Nehemiah, that's Zerubbabel, and he was the descendant of David HaMelech. He would have been the Melech. had there been Malucha, he would have been the Melech. He was the descendant of David HaMelech, direct descendant of David HaMelech. So they were the ones who established the Yishuv in the second Beis HaMikdash and built the second Beis HaMikdash. That Yishuv was relatively small, as you know, many people stayed in Babel. The people, the governing body of Klal Yisrael at the time, were the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. The Anshei Knesset HaGedolah were the greatest Talmidei Chacham of the generation, and there were many Nevi'im who were part of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. The Anshei Knesset HaGedolah are a pivotal group, as they established the davening that we have, the Shemona Esrei. They're the ones who established it, and many other things as well. And we also know from earlier in Sanhedrin that they did something which was perhaps the it could be the most significant change in the makeup of the world, maybe since Matan Torah. They did something which altered the way all humanity thinks. So much so that when we look back to humanity that preceded the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, we can make a mistake and think, as the world does, that we are more civilized than the people who came before the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. We can think that because our whole brain pattern changed with the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. We know from earlier Maseches Sanhedrin that the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah decided that the Yetzirah for Avodah Zarah was overwhelming, and therefore it was impossible to fight anymore. Where normally the purpose of any Yetzirah is that we should struggle and defeat it so that we can grow and become Shleimim and closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But if the Yetzirah is so overwhelming and overpowering that we can't defeat it, or only very few people can defeat it, then the purpose of the Yetzirah is no longer there. So they decided that the drive of Avodah Zarah was too powerful, and therefore they davened and they removed the Yetzirah of Avodah Zarah. The Gemara says any Avodah Zarah that is practiced after that time by the Goyim is Maisei Avaseyim Biyodem. They're just doing that which the ancestors did. They don't really understand it. They don't really have a drive for it. It is just doing that which they are comfortable with, because that's what they did for generations. So they did. They altered how people think. The Gemara says later in Chelek, when we'll talk about Achav and how he was an Avod Avodah Zarah, the Gemara is going to say over there that he's going to appear in a dream, and he's going to say that if you, he's talking over there to one of the Tanaim, if you would have been there, you would have picked up your coattails and run to bring a carbon to Avodah Zarah. It was such an overpowering drive to do it. We look back and we say, it's so foolish. I mean, what kind of foolishness is that to worship, you know, idols, that they're, you know, you man-made things? Like, who, what kind of fool would believe such idiocy? But that's because we don't have the drive. That's because we don't have the drive. A similar drive, which is the drive for Arayus, they dealt with that as well, as we know from the earlier in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that they also said, okay, well, let's get rid of that Yetzirah as well, which would be the second greatest Yetzirah. And they did, but then they realized that that would not be good, because then there would be no more procreation, neither from people nor animals. Not even eggs were laid after they took away that Yetzirah. So they davened and brought it back, but they removed the Yetzirah that people have for their relatives, their close relatives. For immediate relatives, Rav Moshe learns it means sisters and aunts, that he took away that drive for that Yetzirah. those are Arayus. But the rest of it they left in place. Now, Shtatzachfar, the industry for Arayus, just talking about money, the industry for Arayus in the United States is billions of dollars. It's a billions of dollar industry for this disgusting thing called Arayus. That's the type of drive that it is. Avodah Zarah was a greater drive than that. It would be, if it was still around today, it would be a trillions of dollar industry. It was a greater drive than that for Arayus. We say, Avodah Zarah, stupidity. Who would do such a thing? If we didn't have the Yetzirah for Arayus, we would say the same thing about Arayis. Stupidity, who would do such a thing? But we don't mock Arayis, because we all know how difficult of a drive that is. We're all aware of it. We're all familiar with it. So we don't mock it. We respect it, and we do our best to control ourselves and grow. But that's what Avodah Zarah was too. Avodah Zarah was this thing, was beyond that Avodah Zarah, was greater than that of Arayis. So what Avachik and Asagadala did is they completely changed the way we think. A total transformation of how human beings think. That's what they managed to do. Yeah, Josh.
Well, there's a chazal or an opinion that says that the reason why people did Avodah Zarah was an excuse to do Arayis or, immorality.
That it's what the Gemara says, that that's why Klal Yisrael practiced Avodah Zarah in the Midbar was in order to get to Arayis.
Only Klal Yisrael.
It was talking about that Maisa with Midya. It's talking about that specific Maisa.
About in general.
It's talking about that Maisa. Now, so this happened during the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. That's when this incredible transformation took place. Whenever there is a transformation in the Yetzer Hara, there's also going to be a change in the Yetzer Tov, in the drive for doing the right thing. Because it's Zelum Azel Sar Elokim, there has to be, because if you take away the Avodah Zarah, the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, and leave intact everybody's drive to do good, then there's no longer going to be any challenge anymore. Then we're all going to do the right thing, and there won't be any Averis anymore. The drive for doing the right thing will overpower the drive to do the wrong thing, because the drive to do the right thing is so much stronger. And then there won't be any reason to live anymore, because there won't be any reason to struggle. There's no more schar v'aydish, because we're all going to do the right thing. So part and parcel of removing the drive of Avodah Zarah included removing a drive to worship the Ribbono Shel Olam. You see, the drive to worship was removed. What does that mean? That means like this. Before the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the struggle that a person had was, I have to worship. There's a need to worship something greater than me. I'm not the biggest thing. There's a force that's greater than I am, that created me, that I need to worship, that I need to placate if I'm going to have a good life. What is that force? Is it something that has a form, a body, a parts to it that I can describe, like the sun, the moon, the clouds, the rain, the ocean, the birds, etc., cows? Or is it this thing that has no form, no description, the only thing I know about it is that it is one, but I have no understanding whatsoever about it. It doesn't have anything human about it. There are no parts to it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That was the struggle. Am I able to deal with this Hashem that has no humanity or physicality to it? Or do I make this Hashem into something which is physical and is human? That was the struggle that there was before the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. After the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the struggle begins to change. It begins to change slowly but surely from that struggle to what we have today. What's the struggle today in Western man? Do I believe or do I not believe? Do I deal with a greater force than I, or do I believe in secularism? There is no greater force than I. Even those who admit intellectually that there is a greater force than they are, which is most people in the United States today, do believe that there is a God, but we don't deal with that God on a regular basis. It's a struggle to keep that God in mind on a regular basis. When I go about my day, I'm not thinking all day about Hashem. And so too the Goyim are not thinking about whatever religion they have. It's something which is categorized and set aside for a particular time of the week, a particular time of the day. It's not something which is pervasive in our lives. That's the struggle that becomes the main struggle of man. The drive to worship, the need to recognize a greater force, begins to diminish. And today we see it even is the most diminished it's ever been. Most likely it will become even more diminished until Mashiach comes. That happens with the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. This is
deliberately?
Yeah, I mean, this was part of...
They had the kavanah.
Their reason was to remove the Avodah Zarah, the Yetzer of Avodah Zarah, but this is part and parcel of that. It goes together. This is why it is with the Greeks, who are the power that come into play immediately after or at the very end of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. This is why it is with the Greeks that the first time that you have the idea of Greek mythology, you have Avodah Zarah that becomes very, very, it's always been, all the Avodah Zarahs have physicality to them, but it becomes a soap opera. It becomes a story. It becomes something which is like something you tell around a campfire. It becomes this, because what's happening is that the whole idea of a spiritual being is being slowly but surely brought into our world. Really, Greek mythology is the antecedent to Christianity. The whole idea of actually turning God into a human being. That's what's going on there with Greek mythology. That's where it starts, because there was no longer a real drive for Avodah Zarah. Now, they still had Ma'aseh Avosein Bi'adeihem. They still were used to paganism, but it starts to slowly but surely become something different. Alexander the Great is the one who conquered the world with the Greek banner. Upon his death, then the kingdom splits into several parts, which gives rise to the story of Hanukkah under Antiochus, which is one of the parts that it's split into. But he's the one who brings the whole Greek ideals to the world. The Shimon HaTzadik is Mishiyarei Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. He is of the remnant of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. Different pshatim, what that means. Some learn he was part of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. He was the last of them. Maybe he was the last of their Talmidim. Whatever it is, Shimon HaTzadik is the very end of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. Shimon HaTzadik, we know, met Alexander the Great. Where did he meet him? Okay, so we have the famous story brought in Yuma. It's a great story. People like to tell it b'chlal. The great story in Yuma, where also, interestingly, starting with a Maisa Megillas Tainis, the Gemara here says, it's a Daf Samach Tes in Yuma. Gemara says, Ba'asim HaChamisha B'Tevis, the 25th of Tevis, is Yom Har Grizim. That's the day of Har Grizim. So a Lemisbein, that you can't say a Hespin on it. Because that's the day that the Kusiyim convinced Alexander to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, because they said, this is the second Beis HaMikdash, they said that the Jews are out to get you, they're terrible people, and Shimon and Alexander the Great gave them permission, and they were coming with Alexander to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. So Shimon HaTzadik heard about it, he put on his big day kahuna, and he came out of Yerushalayim, and as the sun came up, they met each other. And when they met each other, the famous story, Alexander gets off, he dismounts from his horse, and he bows before Shimon HaTzadik. And they say to him, are you crazy? You're going to bow in front of this lowly Jew? And he says, this is the Mustiuknai. When I'm going into battle, I see the form of Shimon HaTzadik when I win all my wars. So Shimon HaTzadik says to him that, why did you come? I think it's Alexander asking Shimon HaTzadik, why did you come? And he answers, because the place that we daven on you for your success and on your kingdom, and your kingdom, it's going to be destroyed? And he says, what are you talking about? Who wants to do that? And he says, these Kusiyim. And so Alexander says, do what you want with them. And Klal Yisrael there take the Kusiyim and they kill them, and they call that a Yantiv of Har Gerizim. That's the Maisa. So not only does Alexander meet Shimon HaTzadik, which is the time frame that he's in, which is the Shiare Anshe Knesset HaGedoyla, the whole success of Alexander is predicated on Shimon HaTzadik, who is the Shiare Anshe Knesset HaGedoyla. The end of the Anshe Knesset HaGedoyla is the person who is in the mind of Alexander as he defeats and takes over the entire known world. That is all through Shimon HaTzadik. You see that Alexander's kingdom, his rule, his reign, is intimately connected with the Anshe Knesset HaGedoyla, with the Shiare Anshe Knesset HaGedoyla, with Shimon HaTzadik. I'm underscoring the same idea, that it is through the Anshe Knesset HaGedoyla that the world changed its whole way of worship, which is represented by the Greeks. And it is therefore through Shimon HaTzadik himself that they take over the known world. It is with the new world order under the Greeks, and it's a real new world order, far more far-reaching than the fall of the Berlin Wall. I mean, this is a massive change in how people think. And it was triggered by the Anshe Knesset HaGedoyla and brought by Alexander to everybody. When this happens, so there's a brand new world order and everybody's thinking differently. They don't realize they're thinking differently, but everybody's thinking differently. The whole world, everybody, has a new way of looking at things. It is under this new banner that the Umayyads come and say, okay, now what? What's it going to be now? We were under an old world order. Under that world order, there were certain sets of givens, and those givens were around for thousands of years. But now the world has changed. And now things can change all over again. One Ummah can bring another Ummah to justice, which, if you think about it, has some feels like Yemais HaMashiach, where one whole Ummah can come. I mean, where do you ever have such a thing that the Egyptians should take the Jews to court, that the Canaanim should take the Jews to court? It's like the whole idea is fascinating. You can have an Ummah that will now want to establish itself in a certain way, so it goes under this new world order. So come the Canaanim and they say, we get Eretz Yisrael. And, of course, they are refuted. Come the Mitzrayim and say, we get money. They're refuted. Come the Ishmael and say, we get Eretz Yisrael, at least half of it. They're refuted. But as I pointed out before, the reputation is totally different in the last one than it is in the first two. In the first two, not only does Gvir B'Sisa defeat them, but he sends them running. They're beating a fast retreat. The Canaanim take off. The Mitzrim take off. But the Yishmaelim don't take off. This sets the stage for the world order post Anshe Knesset HaGedoyla. The Canaanim are no longer a threat to Klal Yisrael at all. Do they exist? Yes. Sometimes do we get trouble from Canaanim? Yeah. As an Ummah, they are not a threat to Klal Yisrael. They have not only been defeated, they have been chased away. As an Ummah, the Mitzrim are not a threat to Klal Yisrael. The country of Egypt, even though it did have wars with the country of Israel, the country of Egypt is not necessarily, as we mentioned before, not necessarily Mitzrim. There are some Mitzrim there, perhaps. There's a lot of people there who are not Mitzrim. But the Egyptians, as an Ummah, are not a threat to Klal Yisrael. The Ishmaelim, their Taina is defeated, but they're not sent running. They're still there. Nobody ran away. Yes, they were not successful in their lawsuit, but they didn't run away. In the New World Order, they are still a factor. They're still around. And they remain around for this new set of circumstances, which I assume goes on until Mashiach comes. and Yishmael remains as a factor. To me, that is the part of the background, part of the broader understanding of these three lawsuits that come before Alexander, the judge, with Tzvi ben Mesisa. Any questions on this before we move on to the next point?
Is this, if anything, to do the Rambam's statement that the Nektar and Ben Shmuel were Nis'arvo? This is in the Makor? On a different topic. On, I was always wondering about that.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. On Tzadi Aleph and Beis, there are several, it really starts with Tzadi Aleph and Aleph, but Tzadi Aleph and Beis, you have a few things that Antoninus and Rebbe discuss, and a few points that Antoninus, Rebbe says he learned from Antoninus. Now Antoninus, as the Gemaras and Avodah Zarah tell us, was totally kafuf to Rebbe. Antoninus, who was the Caesar, but when he would be with Rebbe Yehuda Nasi by himself, he would be willing to lay down on the ground and let Rebbe step on him to get up into his bed. That's Antoninus says Alashon and Avodah Zarah, Mi Yitain, who would give that I should be a mat underneath your feet in Olam Haba? Antoninus was totally and completely kafuf to Rebbe, to Rebbe Yehuda Nasi. Here, you have some give and takes between the two of them, and Rebbe Yehuda Nasi learns a couple of things from Antoninus. I'm not prepared to take this idea further, but I do want to share with you that Antoninus represents Esav. Antoninus is from Edom. Rebbe, of course, is from Yaakov. Rashi says in Parshas Toldos that when the Pasuk says in the Nevuah that Shem says to Rivka, Ula'oim mil'oim yamatz, that Shnei goyim evitnech u'shnei lu'umim mime'ayach yiparedu, two nations are inside of you and two great nations will separate from inside of you. Shnei goyim bevitnech, Rashi says, altikri goyim ala geyim. Geyim means lofty ones. That's a good word. Lofty ones. Rashi says, that's referring to Elu Rebbe v'Antoninus. This is referring to Rebbe Yehuda Nasi v'Antoninus. Shlapaskum el shulchanam l'tznanu l'chazeres lo'i b'mertzachem v'lo'i b'mertzachshamim. That their tables were never lacking, neither tznain, radish, nor chazeres, whatever that is, some type of lettuce, neither in the summer nor in the winter. Meaning, they always had whatever they wanted. They were so wealthy, they always had whatever they wanted. Rebbe and Antoninus are the anomaly. It's halacha hi, Esav soinei es Yaakov, that Esav hates Yaakov. And they will never get along. That's the halacha. And we know that la'asad lavai, that Klal Yisrael is going to defeat Esav. Uveis Esav Lakash. They're going to be destroyed. Amalek is going to be destroyed from Esav. But there was a better way. Had Esav not failed in his mission, he could have been something part of the central plan of HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
I mean, if he hadn't given up the Bechorah.
If he would have been a tzaddik. Really, as Rashi also says in Parashas Vayetze, why was Leah always crying? Because people would say, Laban has two girls, Rachel has two boys, Hagdolah l'gadol v'haktana l'katan. Leah is destined for Esav, Rachel is destined for Yaakov. That's what was supposed to be. Leah was supposed to marry Esav, and Rachel was supposed to marry Yaakov. That was supposed to be, in an ideal world, that's what would have happened. It's not that they ever would have had a partnership. They never would have had a partnership. Esav could not have been a partner with Yaakov. That's what he couldn't stand. Esav could have been the not as, well, that's saying it a little bit differently than not as a partner. Esav could have been a second to Yaakov, a secondary to Yaakov. He could not have been a partner. Yaakov is the Iker and Esav is the Tuffel. But Esav could have been a tzaddik, married Leah, and would have been the supporting role to Yaakov. That would have been in the ideal world, had Esav done it. V'rav yavoid soyer. The Rav, the older one, it has to serve the younger one. Even if they're going to get along, that's what has to happen. Esav was never able to accept that. And that's why he became a Yisrael Mummer. He ended up leaving. He never practiced his role. Which is why Yaakov had to take on both roles of Rachel and Leah, and marries both of them. That was as a tikkun for what Esav, whatever Esav was supposed to do, now it's within Klal Yisrael. Both roles are within Klal Yisrael.
Even though that wasn't his intent.
Right. He didn't plan it.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
I don't know what would have happened had he married Rachel first. We don't know. And these things, you know, there's no way to know what would have happened. But the kaiches of Esav, of Leah, are now within Klal Yisrael. And that's when you have Yosef from Rachel, you have Yehuda from Leah, right? You have different kaiches over there. And that's the issue of Shalom and Klal Yisrael revolves around this issue constantly. Rachel and Leah.
Zebulun and Yisachar, is that the same relationship?
Because that's a shutfus. That's a real shutfus. I once spoke to my rabbi, Tzvi Berkowitz, about this, and he made it clear to me that it is not so. Esav could never have been a shutfus with Yaakov. He had to be tuffel to Yaakov. Not like Yisachar Zebulun.
Same role, but different than Leah.
He had to be tuffel. He had to accept Yaakov as being the Iker. And he wasn't able to do that. Antoninus is the manifestation of what Esav could have been. Antoninus, who is a Ben Olam Haba, Antoninus and Rebbe, that's what ultimately could have been Yaakov and Esav. The way that Antoninus treats Rebbe, that's what could have been had Esav been able to machnia himself and treat Yaakov that way. That would have been the unit, I don't want to call it a partnership, but that would have been the unit that would have been the central unit of the world, what everything else revolves around. That's what was meant to be. That's why in the Nebuah itself, the first thing that Shem says to Rivka is Shnei Goyim Bevitnech. That's the first words of the Nebuah. Because that's what really, ultimately, was meant to be. That was the perfect picture. Antoninus is the one exception. The reason why the Mishnayos got compiled, got written, was because of Antoninus. Antoninus gave the Jews a hanacha, because at the time of the Romans, the Jews were always being hounded. Antoninus caused that there should be a little bit of a respite. And Rav Yehuda Nasi Rashi explains in the Maseches Bava Metzia was able to gather all of the Talmidei Chachamim together, and they were able to compile the Mishnayos. That was a result of Antoninus making the general stage ready for the Mishnayos to be written. He enabled it. That's what could have been with Esav and Yaakov. That's what should have been. But Nebuch, it didn't happen. In this Gemara, where we have, Rebbe says, Davar Zeh, Limdani Antoninus, is that the Lashon? Davar Zeh. That's Lashon? Yeah, Davar Zeh, it's twice. Davar Zeh Limdani Antoninus. Antoninus taught me this. Again, I'm not prepared to discuss this particular point in a deeper fashion, but the idea that's going on over here is this is something, an insight that could have been learned from Esav. This is where the koyach of Esav is able to give an insight to Yaakov. Rebbe representing Yaakov, Antoninus representing Esav, but representing Esav the way Esav should have been, Davar Zeh Limdani Antoninus. This I learned from Antoninus. This is the kind of thing that I could have learned that Yaakov and Esav, that Yaakov would have gotten out of Esav, that there would have been a greater good through that learning. The Iker is Rebbe. Antoninus, again, will bend down and let Rebbe step on him to get into bed. Rebbe says to him, you can't do that, it's called a malchus. He says, I'd rather be a matzah tachtecha la'am avod. That's what he says in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. But the Gemara here, when they're having these discussions back and forth, and when Antoninus Takta teaches Rebbe something, that's showing us what could have been learned from Esav. That, to me, that's the lens through which to approach this Gemara.
Yeah,
that as a din Torah, or it's just chachma b'goyim? I mean, because he brings a raya from the Torah, is this something that he's mechavin to something?
I don't know how to quantify it. I'm not sure what it is. I don't think it's chachma b'goyim. I think it is in Torah.
Because he brings a raya from
the Pasuk. Right. Had Esav married Leah and they would have had this unit, I don't know what would have happened with Matan Torah. Does Esav also participate in Matan Torah? I don't know. There's no way to guess all of the variables, how things would have happened had it gone right. But clearly there would have been a closer connection to Torah that Esav would have had. That's for sure.
Is that why Yitzchak wanted to give the brachas to Esav?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of his brachas was, so that mean that, how does that fit in with this idea that
Yitzchak, I don't want to get sidetracked on this, but Yitzchak did not have the nevuah of shame. That's the major difference. He didn't have the nevuah of shame. In Yitzchak's mind, and this would have been the natural thing to think, he has two sons, he knows they're from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, they're meant to be partners. That, in Yitzchak's mind, that's what it's supposed to be. And therefore you follow the natural rule, the Bechar and the Katan. The Bechar, he knew that Yaakov was the Talmud Chacham, but he assumed that the Bechar is the one who should be the Gvir, and that's the way it's supposed to work, and you know, and that's more of more glorifying Yisachar's moon type of thing. That was Yitzchak's Kivun. And he wasn't wrong not knowing the Nevuah. That was correct without a Nevuah. That's the way you're supposed to, that is the way to think. But he deliberately was not given the Nevuah. And that's the whole shir. I've given that shir after davening and Shabbos morning before, of why Hashem didn't want Yitzchak to have the Nevuah. He didn't want Yitzchak to have the Nevuah so that what happened would happen. That the whole thing with the stealing of the brachas, all that should take place. That was the plan that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had once Esav failed in his mission. That's what he wanted. He didn't want Yitzchak to have the Nevuah. That was part and parcel of what was going on. That's again a shift from my Rebbe from Ritzvi about that that episode. One more point to share with you for this evening, and then before we leave, I just want to have to mention what's going to happen next week. On Daf Tani Beis Amud Aleph, the Gemara brings a number of memoras from Rabbi Elazar. And the Gemara says, "Vamar v'lazer, gedayla deya shenitna bein shtei oisiyos. Deya is great that it was given between two oisiyos, between two what's an ois? Letters. Shenemar ki kel deyos Hashem. So Rashi explains this means between two names of Hashem." Kael and Hashem. Kael, Deyos Hashem. Rashi gives two Lashonos, whether that means two letters of Hashem's name, or whether it means, because the name of Hashem is called an ois, because it means like a pella, like an amazing thing, an ois. So, the Shem Hashem is not called a teva, it's called an ois. Because it really should have said it's that Deya is great because it was given between two tevas, two words, but instead it says ois. So Rabbi Asa pointed this out to me last week and brought it up and said maybe something to speak about on this. The Marsha discusses this as well. I think what the Marsha is saying is hard to understand. You can take a look yourselves. I found it hard to follow. Dealing with, I think, with something which is a little bit of nister. But I want to point out to you that, to me, this dovetails with a Gemara that I also don't fully understand, but I think that they go together. The Mishnah says in Yuma, Mishnah says in Daf Lamed Ches that there were groups of people in Bayis Sheni who are remembered Lignai. They're remembered for bad. And that, why? Because they had certain skills and they didn't want to teach them. The family that knew how to make the Lechem HaPanim, which was very difficult to make, they didn't want to teach it. So they remember Lignai. The family that knew how to make the Ketores, they didn't want to teach it. So they remember Lignai. Hugras ben Levi, he knew how to sing in a way that was very, very special. He didn't want to teach it. He's remembered the Gnai. Then the Gemara says, Ben Kamsar lo yirotzu lalamed al maisa ksav. Ben Kamsar didn't want to teach about how to write. How to write ksav, how to write the Sefer Torah. And he's also remembered the Gnai. Then the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, Alarishanim nemar zecher tarak levracha. The first one, he says zecher tarak levracha. V'aleinu ne'emar, but on these we say v'shem Hashem Yerkov. Their name should be rot. Their name should rot. So the Gemara goes on to say that the first three, the ones ben, let's see, Beis Garmoy, they didn't want to teach the Lechem Aponim. Beis Aftinas didn't want to teach the Maisak Tiras. And Ben Hugras Ben Levi, who didn't want to teach about the Shir, how to sing. The Gemara finds excuses for those three. Because in all three of them, the reason they didn't want to divulge the secret is they were afraid that someone would learn it and use it for Avodah Zarah. If you know how to make Lechem Aponim, just like you make it for the Beis HaMikdash, you can make it for Avodah Zarah. If you know how to sing beautifully, just like you sing beautifully to Hashem, you can sing beautifully to Avodah Zarah. If you know how to make Ketairis beautiful, perfectly, you can do that for Avodah Zarah too. So the Gemara says those excuses are sufficient. They are taken not remembered like Nai, even though the Mishnah says it. The Gemara says, but in the end, we find excuses for them, and they're not remembered like Nai. However, Ben Kamtzar, he's remembered like Nai, because his skill couldn't be used for Avodah Zarah. Why? What was his skill? Rashi says he was able to take four kulmusim, four quills in his fingers, one between each of his fingers, at the same time, and write simultaneously Hashem's name, Yud Ke Vav Ke. The four letters of Hashem's name, he could write them simultaneously with the four quills in his fingers. An amazing skill. But you can't use that for Avodah Zarah, because Yud Ke Vav Ke is Hashem Hashem. Whenever you write it, you're writing the Shem Hashem. You're not writing Avodah Zarah. He didn't do it to write Hashem Avodah Zarah, Chas V'Shalom. He did it to write the Shem Hashem. So that skill has no excuse. Why didn't he teach it? And therefore, the Gemara says he's remembered like Nai. And the Gemara says, just this is Agav, the Gemara says, by the way, what's the Gnai? In what way are they remembered like Nai? The Gemara says, Dolo Maskinim V'Shamayhu. We don't use their names. We don't name people after these people remember the Gnai. You don't name your child Doyeg. Doyeg Hadomi and Lachel Zalam Haba. We don't name a child Doyeg. You don't name a child Achitaifa. You don't name a child Ben Hugram. Whatever his name is. Hugram?
Kamsa.
Ben Kamsa. You don't name him. Because Rishayim, you don't use their names. That's the terrible travesty that you have today, that people do use the name Nimrod, for example. And it's a terrible thing. The Gemara says, Shem Hashem Yerkov, you don't use their names. It's a Gemara. It's not like an old lifestyle. You don't use the name of Rishayim. You don't name your kids that. Al Kopanim, I don't fully understand. I had this question. Right now in the Kol in the morning, we're learning Ksivas Ha'Yesiyos. That's what we're learning right now. And this Gemara, this mission intrigues me. What's so great that Ben Kamtzar was able to write the four letters of the Shem Hashem simultaneously? Big deal. I mean, good. It's a great, I don't mean big deal, like it's a wonderful skill. But what's so special about it? Like, halachically, what's so special? Here we have a sefer right here. What's so special about being able to do that?
Much fair is that lechachila we write a kesidron.
Kesidron, right. So this is simultaneous. Yeah. You see from here that kesidron means not to do a shaloi kesidron. You don't have to do a kesidron. We declared that this morning. You see, in Lundis, you shouldn't do a shaloi kesidron.
Uh-huh.
Right? Uh-huh. It's a shaloi kesidron, not, right?
Okay.
Yeah, but you see, right?
Yeah.
But what's the big deal? What's so chashuv of being able to do it at the same time? So I'm not sure what the answer is, but I wonder if it's tied with our Gemara that's calling the Shem Hashem an ice. It's called a letter. It's not called a word. A letter is one letter. A word is a formation of several letters coming together. You see, lechatchila, if you could do it, the Shem Hashem should be written as one letter. Not that the letters are connected. You can't do that. It would puzzle it. But that you should write it at the same time as if it's one letter. Yud Kei Vav Kei. The letter is Yud Kei Vav Kei. It's not Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey. It's Yud Kei Vav Kei. Whatever that is. Whatever that is. It's a different entity. It's not just a Yud and a Hey and a Vav and a Hey. That's what I think you see, that idea from the mice of Ben Kamtzar, and here it's supported with the Gemara calling it an ice and not calling it a mila.
Is that related to Echad?
Could be that's the Achdus of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Could be that's what it has to do with. I don't know. Anyway,
you say Zacharias says his shame is one. Shmuel Echad.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, right. Shmuel Echad, right. It's true. Akopanim. Okay.
That is Moshe Rabbeinu.
Just, we're really a little...
Shema Chal.
Shema Yisrael, Shema Kenu, Shema Chal.
No,
but he's saying Shema Yachal. He's saying Shema Yachal.
Shema Yachal.
Okay. But, before we disperse, so the next Gemara that we're going to talk about, Mirz Hashem, is on Tari Beis and Mabez, which is the Meisim Shehafi Yechaz Kol. That'll be the next year.